Welcome to the MTFN Bizcast, a podcast designed to provide information regarding a variety of legal topics. The attorneys at Meisner, Tierney, Fisher & Nichols host new episodes every month covering topics that are current and relevant to business owners, professionals, and members of the legal community. Although we cannot provide legal advice that you can rely on in these episodes, we do hope that they will be helpful to you if and when you ever do need to seek professional advice.
Welcome back to the MTFN Bizcast and our Up for Review segment. I'm James Cisnoski.
And I'm Caleb Gerbitz.
Caleb and I are appellate attorneys here at MTFN, and Up for Review is where we talk about what's going on in this Wisconsin Supreme Court and occasionally the Court of Appeals as well. Now, today we have a special guest with us, Dr. Alan Ball. Dr. Ball is a professor of Russian history at Marquette University in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and Dr. Ball runs a blog called Scow Stats, which keeps track of various statistics on the Wisconsin Supreme Court, who's in the majority, how often, and similar things. Dr. Ball, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Ball runs a blog called Scow Stats, which keeps track of various statistics on the Wisconsin Supreme Court, who's in the majority, how often, and similar things. Dr. Ball, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So, Dr. Ball, I'm really excited to have you here because for nerds like James and I and the probably a cottage industry of people who follow the Wisconsin court system very closely, your website has always been a go-to resource. And at the end of each term, we're excited when we see Dr. Ball has posted the latest statistical analysis from the Supreme Court term, see which justices lined up with which justices most often, who had the longest opinions, who got their decisions out the fastest. It's a very fascinating way to look at the court. And what surprised me when we initially started talking about bringing you into the podcast to talk about this stuff was that you're not a lawyer, that the Wisconsin Supreme Court is kind of an adopted passion. You're originally a professor of Russian and Soviet history. So can you tell us how you went from teaching and studying Russian and Soviet history to adding this project to what you do?
Certainly. I can see why you could regard me as a pretty unsuitable candidate for taking on something like this, because as you mentioned, not only am I not a lawyer, and my area of research and writing in history is not the United States at all, it's the Soviet Union. And so for the first few decades of my research and writing, I was completely irrelevant as far as this kind of project is concerned. But over the last couple decades, my last two books, I began to shift focus towards the topic of Russian and Soviet images of the United States. Say, what did Soviet travelers or Russian travelers or commentators say to the people back home about the United States? It had to do with things like the American political system, the economic system, popular culture, sports, religion, lots of things, including the judicial system. And as you might imagine, when you're dealing with a large number of people over 100 years, opinions varied a lot. Some of the observers were ecstatic. Some were baffled. Some were very critical. But as I got into this, it forced me to start thinking about the American judicial mm-hmm. system, and living in Wisconsin, often the evidence at hand had to do with Wisconsin. And so that's what got me at least starting to think about the judicial system in the United States. And then what really shoved me into the Scow Stats project was my wife, who's an appellate lawyer, and she's long been interested in SCOTUS blog, which deals with the U.S. Supreme Court, and there's a little section in SCOTUS blog on statistics. And one day, maybe 12, 13 years ago, she said, "Why, you know, I wish someone would do something like that for the Wisconsin Supreme Court. Maybe even someone like you, who's not a lawyer, could take a swing yep. at it." So probably during the summer when I had some time, I gave it a try, and she looked at what I turned out and thought, well, you know, it's not completely hopeless. There's some promise there. Keep trying. And so initially, as you can imagine, I was pretty cautious, just doing things like how many decisions, what percentage of justices agreed with other percentages and so forth. But then as the years went by, I grew a little less timid and started doing the, you know, comparisons, analysis, things like that. And that's how it became Scow Stats.
So, Dr. Ball, I want to interrupt the line of questioning here for a second, because I realize that probably most people who listen to Up for Review will know what ScoutStats is exactly, but a few people won't. So can you just very briefly describe what you do on the blog?
Well, it's, of course, as you say, a blog. And initially it was just statistics of like the basic things about number of decisions and who agrees with whom and what kind of cases were being taken. And then as I grew a little less hesitant, I started trying to compare things as I got more data in hand too, not necessarily offering my own opinion so much, but at least branching out a little bit. And for instance, a recent post I did on originalism made me feel a little bit more like a history professor, you know, and more less like a bean counter. But it's a blog that focuses on the Wisconsin Supreme Court, both statistics and, you know, some of my own topics that I think are interesting.
So it's fascinating. So if I can ask, what is the methodology that goes into preparing the statistics? Are you reading every opinion? Are you kind of taking the opinions as a whole and collecting how long the opinions are from there? Like, how do you go from having this pile of thousands of pages of Supreme Court opinions to these numbers? And then, you know, relatedly, the commentary pieces you had recently, like the one on originalism, how do you process all that information?
Well, initially, I didn't read them at all. It was more just, you know, who was in the majority, who wasn't, how many decisions, you know, how many pages, things like that, that you could do without actually reading them. As I got bolder and started getting a sense of what was there, you know, I might say, well, over the years, I noticed there are Fourth Amendment cases pretty much every year. So let's go back and do searches for just Fourth Amendment cases and then see what the issues are, who votes where, you know, what sort of changes are taking place. So it's, I'm never going to, at least so far, read every page of every one of them. It's more, you know, putting the statistics into data sets than analyzing that. I use Pandas. It's a Python library program to work with the data, and then coming up with ideas that seem interesting to me, whether it's, again, who's doing what on Fourth Amendment, or, you know, how many women are delivering oral arguments, or who's saying what about originalism. Often I get ideas from other people. You know, I'm really indebted to other people. Usually they don't want to be identified on the blog. They say, here's an idea, try it, but don't name me, because I still go to the Supreme Court. Gotcha. But that's how it developed. It started strictly just statistics at first, and then, you know, branching out and looking for certain issues, topics, and cases that were relevant.
Okay. Very neat. One of the projects that I've noticed you've been doing is looking back at prior terms. Mm-hmm. And I think you have going back to, correct me if I'm wrong, 1938.
Yep.
So can you tell me what inspired you to take this look at the historical data, and then maybe a little bit of what you've found looking back at the older data compared to today?
Certainly. Maybe the question of why I started doing this is because I'm a historian. And we tend to look backwards. If I've tried to justify that at all, I mean, because I understand that most people, including myself, are primarily interested in the current term, the very recent terms, and not what was going on in the 1950s, say, or the 1940s. But if there's some value in doing it, I would say maybe it can help you get a sense of what's significant now. That is it, has it always been this way, or has it changed gradually over time, or it changed abruptly over time? And if you go far enough back, there are some interesting changes that you asked what some might be. And one might be that, well, is that there were far, far larger numbers of decisions that I just finished, as I think you said, 1938, 1939. There were maybe something like 330 decisions, something somewhere in that neighborhood, you know, well over 300 decisions compared to this year, 45. So much, much larger number of decisions. And then a number of other things follow from that. One is, well, obviously the opinions are going to be much shorter. And in some several dozen cases, they would just be one sentence, a per curiam saying we were simply upholding whatever the lower court did. Also, there are, say, almost all the decisions are unanimous, 92%, 94%. reflecting the fact that the Court of Appeals did not exist at that time, and all decisions are flooding their way, things that the Supreme Court would never take. Very, very few were 4-3, you know, maybe say 1 or 2%. It's like maybe two 4-3 decisions mm-hmm. out of 300 and some cases that they're considering. Very few separate opinions. In the 38-39 term, no concurrences at all, just a handful of dissents. And fairly frequently, if a justice dissented, wouldn't write a dissent at all. It'd simply be a sentence, this person dissented without an opinion. So those things are all different. I guess a more recent difference would be the appearance of women at the Supreme Court. That back then, I imagine if you interviewed almost anybody, mm-hmm. said, can you imagine that there'd be even one woman justice, let alone 6 out of 7? It's completely inconceivable. So that's certainly been a big change with Shirley Abramson coming in 1976, as I recall. And then also women lawyers, that while there were some as early as the 19th century, Lavinia Goodell being the first, that they're very, very few and far between in these earlier decades that I'm looking at. And so it's not until you get to the, say, the last couple decades of the 20th century, I think maybe, if I remember it correctly, 10% of all people who delivered oral arguments in 1980-81 were women. And that reached a high point, I believe, in 2014-15 of 33% of all people delivering oral arguments were women. It's come down a little since then.
Interesting.
The last year I looked at, which is not the year that just ended, but the year before that, I think it was 22%. For the last few years, it was in that area. I'm not sure why, but still, that's a lot more than back in, say, the 1950s. The percentage is highest, by the way, for the Attorney General's office and the public defender, that of all the people delivering oral arguments from the Attorney General's office, depending on what year you're looking at, maybe, you know, a quarter or a third, and maybe as many as a half of all oral arguments from the public defender were women, and fewer from private firms. But that's certainly been a difference. The presence of women isn't bizarre or shocking
right,
any longer
right.
as it would have been back in those earlier decades.
Fascinating. James, do you have any other questions at this point before we start diving into the current term?
No, I was just kind of listening at attention to, you know, his detailed description. It does sound like, based on your analysis, that a lot of the difference, because it one thing that you pointed out that is really shocking to people who practice them, or maybe not shocking, but if we were to see 300 or so decisions coming out of the court now, that would just be absolutely shocking. But you also brought up that at that time, that was, it's pre-Court of Appeals, so the Supreme Court's just hearing everything. And I, that's, you know, obviously a pretty big difference. How much of the decrease in opinions is, do you think, is strictly attributable towards to the creation of the Court of Appeals?
Well, certainly a lot of it. I looked into that before coming here today. I just looked at maybe about an 8 or 10 year period from right before the Court of Appeals. So 1975, 76 in there, to just a couple of years after the Court of Appeals. And the change in the number of decisions is dramatic, say going from 280 decisions in, let's say, 1976, 77, to maybe 80 decisions a couple of years after the Court of Appeals. It doesn't happen overnight. That I think in 1979, 80, maybe roughly half the cases were coming through the Court of Appeals and roughly half were still coming up the old channel from circuit courts or county courts. But that would be, I would think the creation of the Court of Appeals would have a considerable impact on, because the drop was so precipitous. There was a less precipitous drop in, say, the number of unanimous decisions, that going from maybe 92%, 94% unanimous a few years before the Court of Appeals to 66% unanimous a couple years after, which is a lot higher than right now, but still quite a drop. But it continued to drop after that. And so that's certainly been a question that people have raised with me, and I don't have a good answer, whether it's the justices just don't want to do as much, or that they're drafting longer and longer opinions and more separate opinions. And, you know, they figure it's better to do that than to take more decisions. I don't know. Maybe you guys have a better answer to that than I do.
I one of the things I was most fascinated by what you just said there was that the number of separate writings, particularly as a percentage, increased after the formation of the Court of Appeals. And I wonder, and there's probably no way to know this, but to what extent that's a function of the justices taking only the harder cases mm-hmm. that are more likely to be divisive versus having perhaps more time on their hands yeah. to draft competing theories of how a law should work.
There might be a chicken or egg thing that you know, each might contribute to the other, but yeah, it's certainly true. Been the case that there are virtually no separate opinions prior and obviously a lot more now.
And that shows up as a pretty hard line in there's the court pre-court of appeals and the court post-court of appeals. Is that with that kind of
relatively? I mean, it can depend on the justices too. That Shirley Abramson wrote a lot, you know, of dissents. Rebecca Bradley right now is writing a lot, so it probably depends on some justices. For instance, Justice Gableman wrote very few, so it kind of depends on the justice as well.
Sure, makes sense.
So are there any other noticeable changes that you've observed statistically in how the court operated before and after the creation of the Court of Appeals?
I'm sure there are some, none that I noticed or that I can think of off the top of my head, because I haven't really focused on the Court of Appeals. I haven't done much on it. And so the most striking things are the most obvious things to me. It's just the numbers, the points that I've already mentioned.
Let's go ahead and turn to the most recent term, which you've authored a number of great articles on the most recent term and put together some charts. So what would you just kind of throw it open to you? There's a couple of things that I noticed reading your articles that I want to talk about, but let's go ahead and throw it open to you to start with. What are some of the most significant statistical takeaways you saw from the 2022-23 term?
Well, one being probably the most obvious, the relatively very small number of decisions, you know, 45. I mean, they've been around the low 50s the past few years, so 45 is unusually low. And I'm going to be keeping that in mind, looking ahead to the next term, because I noticed recently in an article by Dustin Brown that he said, I think beginning of August, that the court had accepted only 6 cases for review, whereas a year ago it was 33 or something like that. Mm-hmm. And they do have a scheduling conference this week, and you know, maybe they'll load a lot more in, but it makes you wonder, you know, do they have a target in mind? Are they happier with fewer than more? Are they going to try to get it back up? But that was one of the striking things, was a very low number of decisions, 45. Another thing was the 4-3 decisions that last year, not the term that's just ended, but the year before that, they had an extraordinarily high percentage. More than half of all the decisions were 4-3. This year, it was lower. I think I had 31%, which is still quite high, very high, you know, compared to most years, but lower. And it made me wonder if, well, maybe this was just a less contentious term than previously, where there were, you know, COVID mitigation cases, election cases, and that there was just less of that this term. And also makes me wonder about the coming term, where if I had to guess, perhaps there will be more. But that was one thing, the pretty high number, but not as high as the previous term. Another thing that struck me was fragmented decisions.
And this was one of the things I wanted to ask you about. I'm very curious about this.
That the previous term, again, was extremely high. You guys talked about this, I think, a little bit on your previous podcast when you're talking, well, what is a lead opinion? How is that different from majority opinion? And so with a fragmented decision, you have 4 justices who can agree on the outcome, but they cannot agree on the rationale or the reason for that outcome. And so the case is not of much use to lawyers who may have a similar set of facts and are trying to decide, you know, how can we apply what the Supreme Court did? It must be frustrating to you guys.
It absolutely is, because you have a situation where on these facts, this is the outcome, but not one of the opinions is precedential or binding on any other court. Mm-hmm. So it's extremely frustrating. Fortunately, it looks like those numbers have come down a little in the last term.
Well, the term before was, I think, 17% of all the decisions were fragmented, which is extremely
almost
high.
One in five.
And this term, it was 11. So that's lower, but it's still a lot. And one of the things that has struck me over the past several years is that there are persistently high numbers of fragmented decisions that I think the five highest percentages of fragmented decisions have all occurred in the last 8 years. And the average of those 8 years was 11% of decisions fragmented, which is exactly what it was this year. Where, say, in the previous 8 years, only 3% were fragmented, and the previous 8 years before that, only 2%. So that will be another thing to look for in the term ahead, you know, whether it reflects a fragmented court or a contentious court, or, you know, it's hard to be sure. I've heard different things, you know, expressed as theories, but again, that will be something I'll be focusing on. And let's see, original actions was another thing that, where the original action is that the Supreme Court agrees to take a case without having it go through the lower courts at all. They just pluck it right up and deal with it immediately. This past term, there were none. You know, no decisions were filed in cases that were original actions. But the previous few years, there were historically a very large number. I think there were three decisions each of the past 3 years that were original actions. Again, far more than would normally be the case. And that is another thing to keep in mind. There seems reason to suppose that there are going to be more this coming term. They're, you know, gerrymandering decisions.
They've already, two have already been filed. Yes.
Are filed as original actions. Month. Whether the court will take them, I don't know. But still, I would guess there's probably going to be more than zero.
Yes.
Another thing that what interested me was the position of Justice Hagedorn, that over the past few years, he's come to vote less and less frequently with the conservatives and more with the liberals, until the point where this past year, he was actually voting more often with the justices that are regarded as liberals, Anwaltz, Bradley, Dalit, and Kurovsky, than with the conservatives, and especially with Dalit and Kurovsky, which, again, if given the expectations when he first assumed his position on the bench were one thing, and what has developed here, I mean, I was completely wrong in what I was thinking was going to happen. And now we've reached the point where, as I say, in the past term, that he has voted more often with the justices he regarded as liberals than as conservatives. And so that, too, will be interesting to keep in mind as we look ahead to the coming term.
So I think your article also talked very briefly about crossover between the groups. You have kind of the three justices regarded as liberal and the three regarded as conservative, and then Justice Hagedorn being somewhat of a swing vote. Mm-hmm. Besides Justice Hagedorn, have you observed any you know, kind of notable crossover amongst the group in the 4-3 decisions?
I don't recall specifically 4-3, but there are certain types of cases where you can imagine one block managing to chip somebody off the other block and bring them over to their side. So, for instance, occasionally in criminal cases that you could find Jill Kurovsky joining the conservatives. Whether those are 4-3 or not, I don't remember. But, you know, there are types of cases where you can imagine that happening. But the block cohesion, as I called it, among what are the three conservatives and the three liberals has been fairly striking. I mean, there's always going to be some crossover, and there's always going to be some surprising bedfellows where you say a case's past term where you had Justice Ann Walsh Bradley and Justice Ziegler agreeing, you know, in a dissent. Yep. You know, so you can always find that. And so whether you want to be more struck by that as an exception to the rule or to emphasize it as, well, there is no block cohesion. I'm more struck by the block cohesion, particularly recently, you know, where you can have three justices, three liberals and three conservatives voting together almost all the time, you know, 80 or 90% of the time in non-unanimous decisions. But you're right. Certainly there are always going to be cases where you'll find strange bedfellows and
Yeah, I mean, I guess the reason I brought up the question is there's sort of two schools of thought that get thrown around about, you know, what you've called block cohesion. There's the very kind of cynical, pragmatic, mm-hmm. well, they just, you know, this person's going to vote with this block because that's their block. And then you have, you know, kind of the counter narrative that sometimes put out there by, I've heard it from a lot of judges and justices mm-hmm. actually around the country that, you know, courts are not nearly as partisan as people think that they are. And so it sounds like there's, you know, some statistical evidence to sort of that you can look at it, you know, different ways. You can look at it as very cohesive in one sense, but you're right. It's also not completely monolithic.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's certainly extremely rare that you would find two justices, let alone three, voting with each other all the time, 100% of the time. And I have seen that at some point or another, but when it occurs, it jumps out and hits me because it's so unusual. And it's not shocking to find two justices voting with each other 90-some% of the time. It's less common to find three voting with themselves 90% of the time, but we've come really close to that in the past few terms with the three conservatives, Rogan, Zach, Ziegler, and say Rebecca Bradley or someone like Dan Kelly earlier, and then the three liberals become close. But in say, the past several terms, certainly never has there been 100% unanimity among any, even two, let alone three.
So Dr. Ball, I wanted to go back to something that you said earlier. You had mentioned that you had a certain expectation when Justice Hagedorn came onto the court and that your expectations were sort of subverted by his actual voting record. Could you expand on that a little bit?
Certainly. I mean, I and probably plenty of other commentators were assuming that when he came onto the court that he would be a pretty reliable ally of justices such as Rogan, Zach, Ziegler, Dan Kelly, Rebecca Bradley, and so forth. But the trajectory of his influence has been very interesting, surprising to me. When he first arrived on the court, which was 2019-20, as I recall, that at that point, the court was pretty solidly conservative. And as it turned out, the conservative justices did not need his vote to win. So you had Rogan, Zach, Ziegler, Dan Kelly, who voted together almost all the time in, say, 4-3 decisions. Let's take 4-3 as an example here, that maybe 90-some% of the time those three voted together. Obviously, in order to win, they needed one more vote, but it did not have to be Justice Hagedorn. There was also Rebecca Bradley as an option. And so as a result, in that first term, Justice Hagedorn was in the majority in 4-3 decisions only 30-some% of the time. But the next year, the court changed because Joe Kurowski defeated Dan Kelly. And so now we've got what we would have for the next 3 years, which is three liberals and three conservatives, the liberals being Ann Walsh Bradley, Dalit, and Kurowski, and then the three conservatives. But of course, neither side, those trios, by the way, voted together almost all the time, too, in 4-3 decisions. Very, very, you know, upper 80s, low 90s% of the time in 4-3 decisions, but neither could win without a fourth vote. And there was only one person left who could be that fourth vote, and that was Justice Hagedorn. And so in that second year of his tenure, his participation in 4-3 majorities skyrocketed, you know, rather than 30-some percent. The first term, it was now 80-some percent, far higher than that of any other justice. And that would be the case in his third term as well. He was almost always in the majority. It was very hard to win without him in a 4-3 decision. And by the time you get to the term that's just ended, his fourth term, there too, he was pretty important, 71% of the time in 4-3 majorities. But by that point, we see the ascendancy, if I can call it that, of the liberals reaching the point where in 4-3 decisions, they were in the majority as often as he was. It was no longer him, 80-some percent, and everybody else well below. He's 71%. Ann Welsh Bradley was 71%. Dalit was 71%. And Jill Kurowski was higher, 79%. And so another interesting change that took place was going back to his second year, when he suddenly became very important. At that point, he was still voting more with the conservatives than with the liberals in 4-3 cases. the year after that, when they had an extraordinarily high number of 4-3 cases, now it was 50-50, that in 12 4-3 decisions, he was voting with the conservatives. In 12 more, he was voting with the liberals. And then there were a couple other mixed majorities that he was part of, where some liberals, some conservative. But then the year following that, which is the year that just ended, he was in the majority in 10 4-3 decisions, 7 of those with the liberals, and only 3 with the conservatives, no mixed majorities. And so you can see the prevalence of liberals rising to the point where now, as I just mentioned, that they were in the majority at least as often, or in the case of Jill Karolski, more often than he was. And so it will be interesting to see, as we look ahead to the coming term, what sort of role he will play in contentious cases, because you could imagine at kind of one end of the spectrum of possibilities, now we have 4 liberals with Janet Protasiewicz. The liberals might conclude we don't need him. You know, we can get what we like. And in which case his role might fall back to what it was his very first year on the court, where it was the conservatives who said, we don't need him, in effect. You know, they can win without him. In which case we'd expect his percentage to plummet in 4-3 cases. On the other hand, kind of the other end of possible spectrum would be the liberals concluding we should make an effort to try to keep him on board. The liberals seem to be increasingly interested or capable of doing that over the previous 3 years, as I mentioned, that he joins them more and more frequently to the point where it's more often than joining the conservatives. So he seems to be amenable to their efforts, and they seem to be making them, and maybe they would continue, thinking that that would shield us from charges of being politicized or partisan if we can prevail 5-2 with Hagedorn rather than 4-3. So that will be one thing I'll be following carefully. I'm sure a lot of people will be following carefully in the term to come as to where he falls, you know, along that spectrum. Are we going to get a lot more 5-2s or 4-3s, and where will he be?
It will be fascinating to watch, and I'm very much looking forward to the 23-24 edition of Scow Stats, taking a look back at the term. One other statistic I noticed from this past term that was striking was the increasing influence, I suppose, of Justice Karofsky in majority opinions. I think you just remarked that it was 79% of the time she was in the majority, which was more than the rest of the
4-3 decisions.
In 4-3 decisions, my apologies. Which was more than the rest of the court.
Yep.
But it also looks like it's been a year-over-year increase or trend. There's been a trend line from when she joined the court until now, where she's been steadily increasing the number of majorities that she's part of. Do you have, based on your review, do you have any insight as to how that came to be, or what sort of cases might be driving that?
Well, by just a guess, and I wouldn't put too much credence on it, but it is the case that of the various liberals, she seems or is the most likely to break off and join conservatives in certain criminal cases. And so I would say that if I had to venture an explanation for why she's appearing so often in majorities, it's that generally she's going to side with the liberals, but if not, she'll go in at least a few, you know, criminal cases with the conservatives and be in a majority there, where of course the liberals are not. The other remaining liberals are not, and that could help explain why, you know, she is more often the majority than anyone else in the past term.
That makes sense. Well, one of the other things that I am curious about is you recently did this write-up on originalism. Mm-hmm. Could you talk a little bit about what you uncovered as you were, well, first off, what you were looking for and what you uncovered during that research?
Certainly, because this is closer to my sandbox as a historian.
Okay.
Just very quickly, the originalism is a doctrine, an approach that has gained a lot of attention nationally, has provoked a lot of debate. And at the Wisconsin Supreme Court, that debate blew into the open with 2 decisions this past spring, where on the one hand, we have Justice Hagedorn offering extended defenses of originalism in both instances, and Justice Dallet, on the other hand, offering long critiques of it. And just to summarize the positions in a nutshell, which might help explain what originalism is too, defenders of originalism, such as Justice Hagedorn, argue as their centerpiece that if you're going to interpret say a constitutional provision, usually they're talking about constitutions. It could also be statutes, but usually it's constitutions. to apply to a case that you're currently considering. Some sort of issue is before you as a justice, and you have to decide whether, you know, this is comports with the Constitution. If you're going to do that, you have to roll up your sleeves, plunge in the historical sources, and try to figure out as best you can what the views of the framers of the Constitution, the founding fathers, the drafters, thought regarding that particular provision. You know, this is how they understood it. This is what it meant to them. You have to try to figure that out. And then once you've got that, you have to take their view of it and apply it to whatever the case is that's before you. They argue that if you don't do that, if you just have judges or justices deciding what they hoped a constitutional provision meant, or what they liked it to mean, or what it should have meant, or something, then basically you're heading towards anarchy. That, you know, whatever you want to do, you can do, and say, well, it doesn't really matter what the drafters thought. This is what I think it should mean, and I'm going to apply that. And so defenders of originalism would say, if you don't like a constitutional provision, then the Constitution tells you how you can change it. You got to go through the amendment process. You can't just go into your chambers and decide what you think it means that day. If rule of law is going to mean anything, you've got to handle it in that fashion. And Justice Hagedorn, in both of his opinions, quoted U.S. Supreme Court Justice Neil Gorsuch to that effect, saying people who are criticizing originalism aren't really criticizing originalism. They're criticizing written law. You're just not going to have a rule of law if you do whatever you want. Whatever you think a constitution should mean. On the other hand, we have the two opinions by Dallet criticizing originalism, and she offered a number of arguments, among them being that it can often be very hard to figure out what the founding fathers thought a particular provision meant, either because the sources are fragmentary or because they didn't agree among themselves. She also argued that the framers sometimes were very specific about what something meant, that is, you have to be a certain age in order to do this or that, and there's no dispute about that, but that in other respects, they drafted these provisions very broadly, knowing that they couldn't anticipate what was coming in future generations and just expected future generations to apply them as they saw fit. And then also in her opinion, both of them, she argued that even if we could figure out to all our satisfactions what the founding fathers intended, these were white males writing in the late 18th century in the case of the U.S. Constitution, the mid-19th century in the case of the Wisconsin Constitution, and if we could figure out what their views were, and then were forced to apply those to situations today, we would probably come out with decisions that a majority of people simply could not accept, that would eliminate or eviscerate most rights enjoyed by women, racial minorities, other minorities. And so Dallet argued that while it's important to try to figure out what the founding fathers thought, if you can, that you've got to combine that with a lot of other things, you know, early precedent or laws or sort of bedrock principles that you felt underlie the entire Constitution and Declaration of Independence, things like, well, majority views are important, but they have to be balanced with the rights of minorities, things like that. Take it all together and try to figure out an answer to whatever the constitutional question was. So that was the debate. And what interested me about it, apart from just being interested as a historian, was that both Justices Hagedorn and Dallet went on and on and on. These were really long discussions of originalism, which they did not try in any sustained way to connect to the facts of the cases, which were comparatively narrow. And so I got the feeling that they were, in effect, conducting a dress rehearsal, that both of them understood this is coming back in much bigger cases, you know, in the coming term. And we're trying to stake out our ground here right now. Then it wouldn't surprise me if we encounter debates over originalism frequently and vehemently in the coming term, say, for instance, over the gerrymandering case that, you know, is political gerrymandering compatible with the view of the framers of the Wisconsin Constitution, that Rebecca Bradley has already said that it is. Justice Dallet has already said that it's not. So I think we're going to see this originalism argument again before long.
I suspect that's true.
I think more than just you suspect that's going to be true. I think that's a much broader expectation, Caleb. So Dr. Ball, as we're all aware, the Wisconsin Supreme Court will have a new new lineup in the 2023-2024 term, as Janet Protasiewicz, or Justice Protasiewicz, has now taken her seat on the court. Based on the review of this past term and other past terms when the makeup of the court changes, are there any particular statistics that you're going to be keeping an eye on for this coming term as indicators of how Justice Protasiewicz might influence the direction of the court?
Yes, indeed. That's certainly a question I've thought a good deal about. And particularly this year in April during the election campaign where she defeated Dan Kelly, there were a lot of speculation in the media, including headlines, that if she wins, this will result, produce the most liberal Wisconsin Supreme Court since 2007-8. And again, a week or so ago when the new term began, again, more journalist accounts of, well, this is going to be the most liberal court since 2007-8. And I would like to argue or suggest here that I think that's an understatement. That I think the reason that people choose 2007-8 is because that was the last year on the court of Justice Lewis Butler, who is generally regarded as a liberal. He served for four terms, and that 2007-8 was the last. And so during his 4 years, four terms, there were three liberals, people at least regarded as liberals, Shirley Abramson, Ann Walsh Bradley, and Lewis Butler. And they voted together in non-unanimous cases 61% of the time. So it's not exactly a rock-solid block, but 61%, more than half anyway. And the problem for them was that there was no fourth vote, that in a contentious case, there simply was not a fourth vote that they could reliably count on. The closest thing was Justice Crooks, but he joined them only 44% of the time in non-unanimous cases, which is less frequently than he joined the conservatives during those 4 years. And so it's really a stretch, I think, to regard it as a liberal court at all. The reason I think it came to be seen that way was because the court grew so much more conservative when Butler was defeated by Gableman, and then Rebecca Bradley replaced Crooks, and Dan Kelly replaced Prosser. It came to seem more and more conservative, and so in hindsight, the Butler years seemed liberal. But if we compare that to what we've had more recently, the last 3 years, as I mentioned, with another trio of liberals, Ann Walsh Bradley, Dalit, and Kurowski, those three voted together in non-unanimous cases 78% of the time, which is more solid than the 61% of the previous trio of liberals. And I think more importantly, I'd be willing to bet that you can count on the new justice, Janet Protasiewicz, voting with the three liberals more frequently than 44% of the time in non-unanimous cases, 44% being the percentage that Justice Crooks voted with the three liberals back in the Butler years. So when you put those two things together, I think it's a pretty safe prediction to say that this coming court, this current court, is not only going to be more liberal than the 2007-8 court, but the most liberal court any of us have seen in living memory.
That's a fascinating take.
But Caleb, I would agree with you that that's not really the most surprising thing. If you look at the statistics that you've laid out on ScalStats over the last few years, you're right. The blocks are pretty monolithic compared to, 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. And then you combine that with now we're flipping the direction of the court. That statement strikes me as correct.
I mean, there were sometimes three liberals in the past, where you could say Shirley Abramson, going back to people like Justice Heffernan or Bablich, you can find two or three, but you can never find four, not even close. The closest would probably be those Butler years. And so that's why, I mean, unless I am as wrong about Janet Protasiewicz as I was about Hagedorn when he joined the court, it seems like a pretty safe bet that it's going to be a very liberal court.
Now, this assumes the court will take more than the seven or eight cases that are currently on its docket. But
so, Dr. Ball, you've talked about your predictions for the general direction of the court. Are there any other specific things you're going to be looking at in the coming term?
Well, one issue that has interested me and which I'm going to be keeping in mind is the topic of stare decisis, which is a Latin phrase that could be understood to mean basically that it's important to stick with something once it's decided. So let's say once a court has made a decision, it becomes precedent. You need to respect that precedent. You can't constantly overturn decisions or else you're going to lose all respect for rule of law, that people will think, well, why should I even care what the law is if it's going to be something completely different the next day, reflecting simply the whims of whoever happens to be the judge or the justice at that point. I think pretty much any judge or justice would agree that stare decisis is important, respect for precedent is important if you're going to have rule of law. But at the same time, I think pretty much any judge or justice would also agree that there are some cases that need to be overruled. And when this dispute or debate comes up among the justices, those who decide it's time to overrule a particular case usually cite from one or another or several of five factors, which I won't go through them all, but things like, well, the facts have changed over the years, or this particular decision has proved unworkable, or it's simply wrong. And so we need to change it. I mean, we've seen that nationally with Roe v. Wade, where, you know, everyone can agree stare decisis is important. Everyone can agree that certain decisions need to be overruled, where the dispute is, well, which are which?
Right, right.
And so someone can say, well, you know, Roe v. Wade, we've had it for 50 years. Precedent is important. You can't just chuck it out now. And as well, you know, stare decisis is important, but in this case, it's wrong, so we're going to have to overrule it. At the Wisconsin Supreme Court, in relatively recent years, when conservatives were in ascendance, there it was typically the liberal minority who was screaming stare decisis as the conservative court set off on the direction it wanted to follow. For a number of years, there were only two liberals, Shirley Abramson and Ann Walsh Bradley, and they would routinely be saying, stare decisis, precedent is important. We've always done this with this way. You guys can't simply change it and go off in your own direction. And the conservatives would either ignore them, or if they chose to take up the stare decisis debate, would say, yes, stare decisis is important, but here's an exception, and this is why we're doing it. In the term that just ended, there was only one instance where the Supreme Court overruled one of its earlier decisions, and in the process of doing so, engaged in a sustained debate over stare decisis. That was an interesting case because the two justices that were arguing precedent is important, stare decisis is important, we've got to stay the course, were two that you almost never find together, which Ann Walsh Bradley and Justice Ziegler, whereas other justices in the majority were saying, yes, of course, stare decisis is important, but here's a case where the exceptions apply, and so we're going to overrule the decision. So only once, as I say, in the past term. I would be willing to bet quite a lot that in the coming term, we're going to hear a lot more debate, a lot more argument, more frequently over stare decisis, this time probably coming from the conservatives. Now we have a liberal majority, so it'll probably be the conservatives to argue. You can't just chuck aside what we've done in the past. But you could imagine the liberal majority saying, we need to take a fresh look at decisions, say, maybe court's rulings on Act 10 or voter ID. Is it okay to carry guns on Madison City buses? You know, things like that.
Right, yeah. I expect we'll see quite a few decisions along those lines. Mm-hmm. And I imagine there are already quite a few advocates that are positioning their cases in the lower courts to try to get them up to the Supreme Court to revisit a lot of those questions that came up over the last decade plus or so.
I'm sure you're right.
Well, let's close on a fun note. So one of the things that I've enjoyed following is your law firm fantasy league that you run on ScoutStats. Can you just tell us a little bit about that, how it works and how you got into it?
Well, how I got into it. I think way back when my wife was trying to shove me into doing this, she said that, well, maybe she was a way of trying to tempt me to get going, was that it could be fun to have some sort of game quality to it. I think she came across somebody running a game where you got points for correctly predicting how the U.S. Supreme Court would vote on one thing or another. And so I thought, well, you know, that does sound like fun. And I had a daughter who was studying computer coding. And in her computer coding class, they had to come up with a project. And we were talking about that. And we thought, well, maybe she could design a fantasy league where just anyone who wanted to participate could make their own teams. You know, here's a list of law firms and you can choose your own law firms. And maybe there'd be different categories of law firms that some are more likely to be in the court than others. So you can't you know, to have your team composed entirely of, you know, as the preeminent firms, and that it could more or less operate itself. But that proved to be too complicated beyond our means. It would have required a lot, you know, someone to preside over it and deal with bugs and, you know, what do you do when a law firm changes its name and things like that. So that never took off, but I still thought it'd be fun. And so a much simpler version of it that I ultimately hit on was, I'm going to choose all the teams, you know, I'll make up a team and then stock each team with a bunch of law firms and then see how they do have a point system. So if you have, you're on the brief, you do an oral argument and you have a favorable outcome, you get 10 points. If you're on the brief, favorable outcome, and not, you're on the brief oral argument and not a favorable outcome, then 5 points and so on. The scoring system's on the website. And so I just keep track during the term, you know, which law firm score which points and then how each team does. And I've probably done it maybe 7, 8 years, something like that now. And it's been kind of fun. I get some attention, sometimes not attention that I necessarily desire, but someone calling up from one law firm or another saying, you know, disputing my ruling that, you know, we deserve more points. It wasn't, you know, a complete failure. We got this or that. You know, you should have given us something more.
The ultimate metric of appellate performance is how you do on the fantasy law firm league on Scout Stats, I'm pretty sure.
So yeah, it's been fun. In the past, this past season that's just ended, the competition was pretty tight. The one team is the public defender and there's nobody else on their team except the public defender because they're so often. And they rallied, finished very strong and looked like they were going to win. And then in one of the very last decisions, the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty got a victory and knocked their team on the top. So they won this year.
Well, it's a fun corner of the blog that I enjoy watching.
As far as one other thing about it that might be interesting is that, of course, there are some firms on some teams that don't do anything. And so I keep track of that. And if, say, a few years go by, a few seasons, and a firm hasn't been active at all, then when our competition committee meets, we relegate them to the developmental league and bring up firms, you know, that have been more active. And so the rosters are changing a little. And that, too, has occasionally brought me a phone call. But it has been fun overall.
Excellent. Well, we really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us, Dr. Ball. This has been a fascinating conversation about the Wisconsin Supreme Court. So thanks for coming downtown, coming on the podcast and talking to us about this. It's very, very much appreciated.
Yeah, thanks a lot. It was very enjoyable.
Well, thanks for inviting me. It was fun. I enjoyed it.
And thanks to Kylie, our producer, for taking the time to work on this segment.
Thank you,
Kylie. As always, she does a great job. And thanks to everyone for listening to MTFN's Up for Review. And as always, if you have questions or comments, you can find Caleb and my contact information at mtfn.com. And if you have any questions for Dr. Ball, you can find his contact information on his blog, scowstats.com. Once again, I'm James Cisnoski.
And I'm Caleb Gerbitz.
Thank you for listening to this MTFN BizCast. For more information, please visit our website, mtfn.com. There you can access other podcast episodes, articles, and the contact information for our attorneys. To keep up to date with Meisner, Tierney, Fisher & Nichols, you can also follow us on LinkedIn, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter.